So the focus of my talk today will be on a new approach to the scattering problem that arises from a study of symmetries in theories of gauge and gravity. And now I understand that there have been several other seminars on this topic over the past few weeks. So thank you to everyone in the audience today for coming to hear my perspective on this subject. Now, since the primary focus of this talk will be on the scattering problem in theories of gravity, I'd like to begin by convincing you why you should care about it. And to do so, I'm going to start in a much broader context in which the motivation is clear. So let's begin with one of the outstanding fundamental questions in physics, the problem of quantum gravity. And so one way to articulate this problem is through the question, what is the microscopic structure underlying quantum mechanical theories that reduce to or reproduce general relativity at long distances and low energies? Now, while this may be a beautiful and interesting question, it's also rather vague, meaning that it's unclear both what it would mean to answer it as well as where the challenges lie. Nevertheless, we do believe that we've succeeded in answering its analogs for the other fundamental forces. So in order to make this question a little more concrete, let's revisit that story. So one way to understand microscopic structure is through the systematic framework known as Wilsonian effective field theory. And according to Wilson, a theory can be described by an action that in principle includes all terms that are allowed by symmetry. So for example, the generic action in a theory of gravity includes all diffeomorphism invariant terms, or in other words, all scalar quantities that can be constructed from the Riemann curvature tensor and its covariant derivatives. Now the connection to microscopics arises from the principle for organizing these terms, which is that they're organized by energy. And so specifically, if one is interested in physics at low energies, or in other words, over longer distances, and is working with a fixed tolerance for error, then only a finite number of terms in the effective action are needed. And the physical picture for the terms that are dropped is that they're characterizing microscopic physics that simply can't be resolved at low energies. So thus, within the Wilsonian framework, we can envision an answer to the problem of quantum gravity in the form of specifying all the coefficients of the terms in the effective action. Now, the challenge with gravity is that it's non-renormalizable, meaning that we don't expect to be able to capture physics at energies comparable to the Planck scale by a finite number of terms with non-vanishing coefficients. So another way of saying this is that quantum loops are generically expected to generate all terms that are allowed by symmetry. So thus, by looking at the problem of quantum gravity through the lens of effective field theory, we've gained a language for formulating an answer, but we still have no substantial insight into the physics since it now involves an infinite number of parameters that are undetermined by this framework. Nevertheless, it is now clear that in order to learn anything meaningful about the microscopic structure of quantum gravity, we need to uncover more structure within this set of infinitely many parameters. So upon embarking on this quest, one of the first things to notice is that the coefficients in the effective action actually aren't a very efficient way to parameterize different microscopic structures. So rather, there's an enormous redundancy since actual observables are invariant under field redefinitions. So for example, in four dimensions, all dimension four terms, which include all the curvature squared corrections, can be removed using field redefinitions and dropping total derivatives. Now, on the other hand, this fact is manifestly incorporated in on-shell scattering amplitudes, which are, of course, invariant under field redefinitions. So for example, using on-shell techniques, it's easy to write down the most general three-point graviton scattering amplitude that's consistent with Poincaré symmetry. And what one finds is that there are only two distinct structures. And these can be readily associated with terms in the effective action by an individual analysis. So specifically, one of them scales like momentum squared, meaning that it can be identified as arising from an Einstein-Hilbert term, whereas the other one scales like momentum to the sixth, and thus could have only arisen from a dimension six, or in other words, curvature cubed term. So therefore, at this order in a low energy expansion, there are in fact far fewer parameters than one might have naively thought by just examining most general Wilsonian effective action. And so the overall purpose of this slide is to simply advocate that we approach quantum gravity with sharp questions that are phrased in terms of observables and that the scattering amplitudes comprise a natural set of these observables. So thus, we arrive at the notion that the scattering amplitudes, in fact, represent a direct approach to the problem of quantum gravity that is both sharp and physically meaningful. And so, in other words, our interest in this question, what is the space of consistent UV-complete scattering amplitudes in gravity, resides in the fact that it should be regarded as directly addressing a fundamental problem of physics. So now that I've hopefully convinced you that the scattering problem is a lens through which we can directly attack this problem of quantum gravity, let's reassess the challenges from this vantage point. So first recall that the major challenge within the Wilsonian framework was that it provided relatively few rules for constructing effective actions, which ultimately left us with a vast number of a priori consistent microscopic theories of gravity. Now, on the other hand, scattering amplitudes are known to be subject to a number of constraints and consistency conditions. And I think it's fair to say that we don't even have a comprehensive understanding of what the full set are. Nevertheless, to illustrate this point, let me begin by listing a few. So one consistency condition is that we assume that scattering amplitudes are capturing causal and unitary physics. And mathematically, this implies that the coefficients that appear in a low energy expansion of the amplitude are subject to a variety of positivity conditions. And notice that these constraints, in fact, made no appearance in the standard Wilsonian picture. Now, another condition arises from a general feature of general relativity, which is that black holes form when a given amount of mass and energy is compressed within a region the size of its Schwarzschild radius. Yes, Lee.
Yes. You didn't mention, you went by it quickly, but you didn't mention that the curvature square terms in an expansion of the kind that you were stating lead to problems with unitarity and stability. And you might have ruled them out at that point.
That's right. But I think the statement there, right, is that if you want to look at scattering amplitudes, which have nice properties and have correct weak coupling, sort of a weak coupling expansion, then you run into those causality constraints. Yes. Yeah, that's correct. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I don't think that changes your conclusion.
No, that was just to make a point. I was trying to lead you from, you know, what you might have, like a Wilsonian picture to why you should care about scattering amplitudes. And that was.
Can I ask a question while you're stopped?
Yes.
So, I kind of am sympathetic to what you're doing here because at some level you're making guesses about the UV completion and asking kind of how that guides you, and you're using scattering amplitudes to kind of guide that guess. But for example, the statement about universality, where there's the assertion about black holes forming. That's a classical statement, and the corrections to the classical approximation, are become large at high energies. And so supposing I was a curmudgeon and said I don't really believe that's what happens at high energies. How do you know that this is what the universality is what's going on? Is it basically an assumption or?
Yeah, I think you should take it as an assumption. And so I think, in some ways, the name of the game, right, is to impose physically reasonable assumptions, translate them into precise mathematical constraints, and see what you get. That's sort of generally the way I view this program.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, so I said that there's this sort of physically motivated condition that pertains to black hole formation, and the mathematical translation of that statement is that mathematically scattering amplitudes it requires that scattering amplitudes it imposes a universal constraint on the high energy limit of scattering amplitudes. And so the final thing is that the final constraint I want to draw your attention to is that scattering amplitudes are also required to emit universal behavior at low energies through what is known as the soft theorems. And what's particularly powerful about these low energy constraints is that they are a direct consequence of infinite dimensional symmetries. And so the point I want to make now is that in light of this collection of constraints, we have a very different picture than we had previously. So in particular, this suggests that the anything goes scenario is really not an accurate characterization of consistent UV complete theories of quantum gravity, but rather there actually seems to be underlying structure that's highly constrained. And so thus we can also now identify that part of the challenge at this point is to find a uniform way to implement all of these different conditions. So the rest of my talk will be divided into sort of two major parts. And the first part will focus on infinite dimensional symmetries of the scattering problem and their connection to the behavior of scattering amplitudes at low energies. And it turns out that the infinite dimensional symmetries and theories of gravity include a Virasoro subgroup, which is the local conformal symmetry of theories in two dimensions. Now, the emergence of this symmetry group inspires the idea that scattering in a four-dimensional theory of gravity might be holographically dual to a conformal theory in two dimensions. And so the second part of the talk will investigate the implications of taking this idea seriously. And so in particular, I'll present a natural reformulation of the scattering problem that's prompted by this symmetry. And then I'll explain how this reformulation seeks to address the challenge of uniformly implementing constraints on behavior at both that arise from behavior at both low and high energies. Okay, so with that, let's turn to this story of infinite dimensional symmetries and theories of gravity and the constraints that they imply on the scattering problem. Now, to ensure that we're all on the same page, I'm going to start with a general picture for what I mean by symmetry in the context of a scattering problem. Equations that leave the laws of nature, or in other words, the equations of motion unchanged. And this implies that symmetry is mapping solutions into solutions, and thus are useful for generating new solutions if we happen to have some old, if we happen to already have some. And sort of the most common example are physical systems that are time translationally invariant and thus emit families of solutions that are interrelated by shifting the time parameter. So now I spent a good part of the first part of my talk convincing you that you should care about the scattering problem, but I have yet to state exactly what I mean by it. But it's basically what you think. So namely, the scattering problem is the physically intuitive question, given the state of our system at some early time, what will it be at some very late time? And the usual assumption is that at early and late times, the relevant degrees of freedom are far separated and non-interacting, so that all the non-trivial dynamics is captured by a map called the S matrix that specifies the final state that a given initial state reaches under dynamical evolution. So then, in the context of the scattering problem, a symmetry is a transformation of both initial and final states that preserves the S matrix. So in other words, in this context, solutions come in the form of pairs of initial and final states that are related by time evolution, and symmetries are transformations that generate new pairs that are still related by time evolution. And so one of the points I want you to take away from this slide is a pragmatic perspective of symmetries in this context as being specified by their action on initial and final states. So with that perspective in mind, let me now provide a heuristic argument for why one might expect infinite dimensional symmetries in a theory of gravity. Now, since I argued that the relevant and defining feature of symmetries of the scattering problem was their action on initial and final states, let's be very pragmatic and think about symmetries in terms of transformations that could be measured by observers who are monitoring these initial and final states. Now, if we focus on the massless scattering problem in which the degrees of freedom are moving at the speed of light, then we can imagine the region of space-time where the final state observers reside as the place that light rays reach after propagating for an infinite amount of time. Now, since light rays can propagate in any direction, this region has a sphere's worth of directions. And we'll call this sphere the celestial sphere. Now, in order to properly monitor matter that's exiting the sphere, we should really populate it with a final state observer at every angle. But now let's revisit this very simple example of time translations, which recall implied families of solutions related by a shift in the time parameter. Now we can imagine that each observer exercises this symmetry to reset their watch. However, since our collection of observers are sitting at different points on a sphere of infinite radius, they're out of causal contact with one another and unable to collectively synchronize the action of resetting their watches. So what this implies is there's actually an independent time translation symmetry for every observer, or in other words, each point on the sphere, and since there's a continuum of points, there are an infinite number of symmetries. And so thus what we found is an infinite dimensional enhancement of the translation group. And these symmetries were in fact first discovered in the 1960s by the general relativists Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzner, and Sachs, and they are called super translations. So now that we have a rough idea of why there are infinite dimensional symmetries, I'd like to provide a little more intuition for what they are, in other words, what they do to solutions. And this, I need to introduce a few more concepts. So specifically, on the last slide, I argued that the region of space-time where we need to place final state observers is a sphere. And that isn't quite the whole story. But we can immediately see what's missing with the following thought experiment. So suppose you have a light bulb and you flash it at some time t equals zero. Then the light rays that are emitted at this time will propagate outward to a sphere of infinite radius. So far, so good. Now, but next, suppose that you flash this light bulb again 10 seconds later. Now, once again, the light rays emitted at this delayed time will propagate out to a sphere of infinite radius, but it cannot be the same sphere as the one from the original flash. And the reason is that if both signals are propagating at the speed of light, then the second one should never be able to catch up to the first one. So therefore, what we've learned is that the region of space-time that is reached by all outwardly propagating light rays cannot be just a sphere, but rather also must include a time direction. And this is usually called retarded time. So this diagram here is a Penrose diagram, and basically they're useful for visualizing these ideas. And so the basic idea behind a Penrose diagram is to depict the entire space-time, including the boundary, on one page. And here, time increases as you move up the diagram, and light rays move at 45 degrees. So now, for example, on this diagram, we can immediately see that light rays are emitted from the origin at some earlier time reach a different point on the boundary than light rays that are emitted from a later time. Moreover, in order to represent 4D space-time on a two-dimensional space on a two-dimensional page, every pair of points represents a two-sphere. And on this diagram, points on opposite side of the origin here represent antipodal points on the two-sphere. And so here we can also see that the place that is reached by all outwardly propagating light rays that are emitted at a particular time forms a sphere. And from this diagram, it's also clear to see that these points, the points on the sphere, are out of causal contact with one another. And so finally, the last thing to say is that the surface that is reached by light rays that are emitted over all times is this three-dimensional surface, and it's called future null infinity. And so basically, this is the place that we want to populate with final state observers in the massless scattering problem. So with this picture at hand, let's revisit the supertranslations, which were independent time translations for every angle on the celestial sphere. So now suppose we begin with a solution which there is a burst of radiation that, let's say, comes out at retarded time t equals zero. And in particular, let's suppose that there's actually, in fact, two bursts, one that comes out of the South Pole and one that comes out at the North Pole. Now, if we act on that solution with an ordinary translation, then we can relate it to a solution in which both bursts are delayed by, let's say, 10 seconds. Or we could relate it to a solution in which they're delayed by 20 seconds or an hour. The important point is that if we're using an ordinary translation, we will always find that the bursts of radiation come out at the same time. Now, what's special about supertranslations is that if we act with a supertranslation on this original solution in which both bursts come out at the same time, well, we can use a supertranslation to relate it to a solution in which only one of the pulses, say the one at the South Pole, is delayed by 10 seconds, while the one at the North Pole still comes out at the retarded time t equals zero. So that is to say, supertranslations don't preserve the synchronization of events at null infinity. So now that we have an example of an infinite dimensional set of symmetries that arises in a theory of gravity, let's try to understand what sort of constraints they imply on the scattering of the softness. So while the supertranslations were originally discovered in the context of general relativity, soft theorems originate from a study of the scattering problem from a historically different context, namely quantum field theory. And in a quantum field theoretic context, the initial and final data of the scattering problem is typically organized in terms of particles. So the scattering problem then becomes the question, given some set of particles with certain energy and momentum at some very early time, what are the particles that we find at some late time? And the solution to the scattering problem comes in the form of scattering amplitudes. So what a soft theorem is it's a universal relationship between a scattering amplitude in a limit in which the energy of a massless external particle is taken to zero and a scattering amplitude without that particle. So at face value, actually, such relationships are rather remarkable given that scattering amplitudes are typically very complicated and can't be exactly calculated. And so the standard physically motivated justification for their existence is that low energy particles can only probe long distance physics and thereby capture universal properties of the scattering process. But if we recall this previous discussion that symmetries of the scattering problem relate different pairs of initial and final states, then it's natural to suspect that such an exact relationship between scattering amplitudes is actually a result of a symmetry. And so that's precisely what I will now show. So for the purpose of this talk, let's focus on Weinberg's soft graviton theorem. And so this theorem pertains to scattering amplitudes or scattering processes in which a graviton is emitted. And so here we're going to find it useful to parameterize the momentum of that graviton in terms of an energy and the direction in which it's propagating, which we can think of as specifying a point on the two-dimensional sphere. So then the statement of the theorem is that a scattering amplitude for emitting a graviton develops a pole in the energy of that graviton in the limit as that energy is taken to zero. And so here, this expression essentially picks out the residue of that pole. And what the theorem says is that the residue of that pole is given by the amplitude without that graviton multiplied by a universal number, which is known as the soft factor. And this soft factor depends on the momentum of the other particles that are participating in the scattering process and the direction in which that soft graviton is propagating. So now it turns out that there's actually a sort of systematic procedure for turning soft theorems, such as the one that I just presented, into statements of invariance of the S matrix under infinite dimensional symmetries. So let me now go through that procedure. So the first thing is that we can regard this soft factor as the eigenvalue of single particle states under the action of some operator I'm going to call QH. Under some operator I'm going to call QH that implements a transformation delta that depends on the direction theta phi towards which this graviton is propagating. So what this does for us is this allows us to interpret this right-hand side as the net transformation of single particle states that comprise the scattering state under this transformation delta of theta and phi. And so what that means is that the SOF theorem can be interpreted as the statement of invariance, that is, as a statement that this S matrix is invariant under this transformation delta theta phi, provided that a soft graviton is added. So with that interpretation in mind, let us introduce a second operator, QS, which simply adds soft gravitons to the scattering state. And what this allows us to do is that now we can write the left-hand side in a similar form as the right-hand side. And upon rearranging the soft theorem by basically bringing both of them to one side, we arrive at the statement that the S matrix is invariant under a symmetry that's generated by a charge, Q, which is given by the sum of this QH and QS. Now, since we can repeat this argument for every possible direction in which the soft graviton can propagate, we conclude that the S matrix is invariant under an infinite number of symmetry transformations in the sphere associated to the direction that the graviton is propagating. Now, in order to see why this set of symmetries are in fact the same as the supertranslations that I described earlier, it's helpful to parameterize the symmetry instead by a function, an arbitrary function, rather than points on the sphere. And upon doing so, we find that the eigenvalue of single particle states under the charge QH are now given by the energy of that particle multiplied by the function evaluated at the point on the sphere towards which this hard particle is propagating. So now consider the special case in which this function is a constant. Then the eigenvalue is just the energy, and we can immediately identify the symmetry transformation as an ordinary time translation, since this is precisely how a momentum eigenstate transforms under an ordinary time translation. Now, on the other hand, when f is an arbitrary function, then the transformation becomes a time translation that is modulated over the sphere by this function f. Or in other words, f is parameterizing the amount of time translation at each point on the sphere. And since f is an arbitrary function, this means that there's an independent time translation symmetry at every point on the sphere, which is precisely what we said the supertranslations were. So at this point, based solely on the action of the hard charges, or these QHs, we were able to identify the infinite dimensional symmetry of the S matrix that's implied by Weinberg's soft graviton theorem with the supertranslation symmetry. However, we also saw that the addition of the soft charge, which was adding soft particles to the asymptotic state, was crucial to the interpretation of the soft theorem as a statement of symmetry. And so thus, to fully appreciate the way in which supertranslations constrain the scattering problem, we should try to better understand the role of the soft charge. So from the previous analysis of scattering amplitudes, we found an expression for this soft charge that involved creation annihilation operators or creation annihilation modes of soft graviton. And we've included this extra factor of omega, remember, to pick out the pole. Now, if we write this instead in terms of field operators, then we can identify the soft charge as just the zero frequency component of the first time derivative of the radiative gravitational field. So hence, at the classical level, the conservation law associated to supertranslation symmetry constrains the zero frequency component of the radiative gravitational field, which for the scattering of point particles is required to be given by Weinberg's soft factor. Now, phrased in this way, it actually sounds a little unphysical, or more specifically, it sort of sounds like the part of the data that's being constrained is something you can't really measure. But in fact, it really is just poor phrasing, because if we set omega to zero, then we recognize that this is really just a total derivative in time, and thus the zero frequency component is equivalent to a net shift in the metric, or more precisely, the asymptotic metric in time. So, in math terms, this essentially amounts to the observation that a Fourier transform of a pole in frequency space is a step function in time. And it turns out that in fact, it was already known how to measure the net shift in the gravitational field. It just hadn't been identified as part of the scattering data that's constrained by asymptotic or by these supertranslation symmetries. And so in particular, I've included here a clip from a paper by Braginski and Dorn from 1987, where you can see that they have an equation that relates the change in the asymptotic metric to what in hindsight we can recognize as actually the soft graviton factor from Weinberg's soft graviton theorem. And it was actually originally explained by Polnarev and Zoldovich in 1974 that this permanent shift in the metric could be measured through the relative displacement of a pair of inertial observers. So the basic idea is to consider the effect of a burst of radiation on a pair of inertial observers. Now, before the burst, they will be separated by some fixed distance. And as the gravity wave passes, it will cause the distance between them to oscillate. And after it passes, they'll again be separated by some fixed distance. But the key observation is need not be distance as the original displacement. And so the upshot is that the net change in their relative displacement is directly related to the net change in this asymptotic metric. So mathematically, the relation between the change in their relative displacement and the change in the asymptotic metric can be derived from the geodesic deviation equation. But the main point I want to make is that there is a physical observable associated to the scattering data that appears in the soft charge. And so in particular, we could exploit this effect to reconstruct the angular distribution of soft radiation by tiling the celestial sphere with inertial observers and measuring the change in their relative displacements. And a final comment I want to make is that we can interpret the change in the relative displacement of inertial observers as characterizing a change in the gravitational vacuum configuration, where inequivalent vacua correspond to inequivalent connections on the celestial sphere. And so thus, we learn that the soft charge is accounting for the transformation of the vacuum, and therefore supertranslations act non-trivially on the gravitational vacuum. Okay, I'm actually going to skip this for now. It's a little bit of a tangent.
Yeah, my ask here. So, in which sense these vacuum are inequivalent? Yeah, after all, they're related by gauge transformation. Yeah, and we know that, and if we're adjusting our detectors, physically after, the wave passed. Yeah, of course, comparing the final state to initial state, we get this gravitational memory. But if we just start, from scratch, after the gravitational wave, we won't know that it was there, or we will. Yes, I think that's my question.
Sorry, your question is, can you say the last part again?
Yeah, so I'm saying that if we didn't know about gravitational wave, and if we just set up detector afterwards, we cannot really measure that there was a gravitational wave before, right? So we can only understand it by comparing the two. So in this sense, it's not like electric charge, for example, which we can just measure at any moment of time. So I wonder in which sense this inequivalence.
I'm saying that yes, you had to have known, let's say, how far apart your two detectors were before the gravitational wave is passed.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare that to their distance after the gravitational wave is passed.
Yeah, that I understand. But, okay. There's a difference here for me from, when you say these two vacuum are inequivalent. Yeah, in which sense they're inequivalent? I think I have a problem here. So I can only understand that they are different by comparing, by basically having this.
You can only understand that they're different by comparing. That's correct.
Right. But but if I just start my evolution, some given moment, I cannot really distinguish these two vacuum from each other. Yeah, so that's kind of confusion I have.
Another way to say it is that, suppose that there was only one vacuum,
mm-hmm.
then you would never be able to see a change in distance, right?
Okay, maybe, move on. Maybe I will ask this question later also, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a tangent. I can actually explain this better, but it would take me sort of off track. So maybe hold it for the end. Okay. So basically I've concluded the first part of my talk, and the basic message that I wanted to convey was that the infrared sector of the scattering problem in gravity is tightly constrained by symmetry. But if we return to the motivation for the studying the scattering problem, we remember, of course, that ultimately our interest lies in UV physics. Now, according to Wilsonian dogma, the physics in the infrared is insensitive to the physics of the UV. So clearly we're in need of a new approach or perspective on the scattering problem in which the UV and IR physics are not entirely decoupled. And now, in fact, we already know of a class of theories in which UV and IR physics are related by symmetry. Namely, these are conformal field theories. But of course, the coupling in gravity in four dimensions is not dimensionless, so there isn't a conformal symmetry in four dimensions. Nevertheless, in this part of the talk, I'm going to explain how there's actually a conformal symmetry of theories in two dimensions, which does relate UV and IR physics. So in the previous part of the talk, we studied Weinberg's soft graviton theorem, which was a statement that was characterizing the universal behavior of the singular part of a scattering amplitude and an expansion about low energy of an external graviton. But more generally, scattering amplitudes admit a Laurent expansion in the energy of an external graviton, and the equivalence between soft theorems and symmetries is a more general phenomena that extends to subleading orders in this expansion. So in particular, the first subleading term in the gravitational scattering amplitudes also takes a universal form. And if we follow an analogous procedure as we did for the leading soft theorem, then one can identify the infinite dimensional symmetry associated to this subleading term with the local conformal symmetry of two dimensions, otherwise known as Virasoro symmetry. And so this observation leads to the speculation that a conformal theory in two dimensions might underlie the scattering amplitudes in a four-dimensional theory of gravity, quantum gravity. And so, in other words, that scattering in four-dimensional theories of quantum gravity is holographically dual to correlation functions in a two-dimensional conformal theory. Now, of course, providing an intrinsic construction of such a holographic dual would be a major breakthrough. And at this point, no such proposal exists, but it's nevertheless proven enlightening to take this idea somewhat seriously and recast scattering amplitudes in a manifestly 2D covariant form. So in order to make use of this 2D conformal symmetry, it first helps to understand where it came from. And the answer is that the reason why we found the two-dimensional conformal group as a symmetry of scattering of the scattering problem in four dimensions is simply that the Lorentz group in four dimensions, SO3,1, is isomorphic to the global conformal group of two dimensions, SL2C. So then, if we want to make this symmetry manifest, we should construct observables that transform simply under 2D dilations, since this is a familiar signature of conformal symmetry. And more specifically, since we're studying the scattering problem, this means we should construct scattering states that transform simply under 2D dilations. Now, standard scattering states are momentum eigenstates, which diagonalize the translations. On the other hand, states that transform simply under dilations are going to be states that diagonalize the dilation generator, or equivalently, the Lorentz generator, which turns out to be a boost. And so the 2D conformal symmetry will be manifest in scattering amplitudes of boost eigenstates. So in order to construct such states, the first step is to identify the two dimensions in which the conformal symmetry acts. And for massless momenta, the trick is to notice that if we parameterize them in terms of energies and a direction of propagation, then they are naturally associated with points in two dimensions, namely the point on the unit sphere towards which that momentum is directed. Now, if we boost in the direction of that momentum, well, that just rescales the overall momentum, which we can see acts like a dilation on that sphere. So therefore, diagonalizing boosts along the direction of the momentum is equivalent to diagonalizing dilations on the sphere. So mathematically, to diagonalize these boosts, what we want to do is identify the generator and then find the integral transformation that diagonalizes this. So this is directly analogous to how we use a Fourier transform to diagonalize translations. So in this case, this is the proper, this is the generator of that boost, and the integral transformation that diagonalizes it is a Mellin transform. And so therefore the procedure for obtaining boost eigenstates is to first parameterize momentum in terms of energies and points on the sphere, and then Mellin transform with respect to that energy. And so what we see is that in this basis, particles no longer carry definite momentum and instead are labeled by points on the sphere and boost weight delta, which is really just the eigenvalue under a boost in the direction of this, in the direction of x hat. So if we do this procedure for every particle in a scattering amplitude, then we obtain what are now called celestial amplitudes. And these simply represent the scattering of particles in boost eigenstates. And so the idea was that this presentation renders the 2D conformal symmetry manifest. And so I actually mean something technical by that, so, have a little bit more technical discussion. And what I really mean is that in this basis, scattering amplitudes transform like correlation functions of conformal primary of primary operators in a 2D conformal field theory. So in order to see this, the first thing is that in conformal field theory, it's often convenient to study a theory on a plane instead of a sphere. Nevertheless, we can easily do this for the celestial amplitudes by using stereographic projection. So in particular, we can associate points on the sphere to points on the plane with a stereographic projection, and therefore replace these labels, which were originally sort of the direction of the momentum, with points on the plane. And here I've used the standard convention where I'm labeling points on the plane with complex coordinates C and Z bar. Now, in 2D conformal field theory, coordinates on the plane undergo Mobius transformations under the global conformal group. And what one finds is that under such transformations, then the celestial amplitudes transform like correlation functions of local primary operators in a conformal field theory. And so in particular, what one finds is this boost weight plays the role of a conformal dimension. And if we had a particle with spin, then helicity plays the role of spin of that operator. So now that I've introduced the basic idea for a new approach to the scattering problem, it's time to revisit the constraints. And the upshot will be that in this language, they're forced to take a simple and manifestly Lorentz covariant form. So for a concrete example, let's focus on the 2-2-2 celestial amplitude and start by doing the easiest thing of imposing kinematic constraints. Now, since Lorentz symmetry is captured by 2D conformal symmetry, then we can use the well-known result in conformal field theory that the four-point function is fixed by conformal invariants up to an undetermined function of the conformal cross ratio, which is this combination of the points. And thus we deduce that the 2-2-2 scattering amplitude must, that Lorentz invariance fixes this 2-2-2 scattering amplitude to be of this form. However, celestial amplitudes respect not only the Lorentz symmetry, but the full Poincaré. So they must be Fuller constrained by the translations. And so these constraints are usually understood in terms of momentum conservation. Now to see how this is captured in celestial amplitudes, first note that momentum conservation forces all four spatial momentum to lie on a plane. So more explicitly, any three momentum specify a plane in 3D, and momentum conservation essentially forces the fourth one to lie in that plane. Now this plane intersects the celestial sphere in a circle. So momentum conservation forces these points to lie in a circle. And under the stereographic projection, this becomes equivalent to the constraint that the conformal cross ratio must be real. So the upshot is that Poincaré symmetry seems to tell us that the amplitude for 2-2-2 scattering for the 2-2 scattering problem is completely determined up to a function that depends on the conformal dimensions of the external particles and the real part of the cross ratio. So that's a nice result, but if we actually think about it for a second, it's a little disappointing. And that's because we really actually expect Poincaré symmetry to be more constraining. And the reason why we expect that is from the story of momentum space. So let's recall what happens there. So in momentum space, we can use Lorentz symmetry, and that tells us that the amplitude should really only depend on Lorentz invariants, which we can construct by taking inner products of the external momentum. Then translations further imply that, in fact, only two of these are independent. And we usually choose to work with S and T, so we usually choose them to be the center mass energy and the momentum transfer. And so thus in momentum space, the 2-2 scattering amplitude is fixed by Poincaré symmetry up to a function that only depends on two parameters. And so we'd like to understand, of course, whether something similar applies for these celestial amplitudes. So how might that happen? Well, the first thing we can notice is that, in fact, the conformal cross ratio, can be identified with the ratio of these two invariants. And so then the question becomes, what replaces sort of the overall scale? So to answer this question, let's just take this constrained form of the momentum space amplitude and put it on the celestial sphere. So given that the ratio of the two Mandelstam invariants we could identify with the cross ratio, let's introduce a second parameter, omega, which is effectively like a center mass energy squared, or a center mass energy, and write them in terms of these two. Now, I had argued that momentum conservation, which in momentum space is captured by a delta function, constrains the cross ratio to be real. So that means that one of these delta functions has to be that constraint, and the other three essentially constrain ratios of the energies. And finally, we can perform a change of variables on this measure and write it in terms of this total center mass energy and in terms of the ratios of the other of energies of the other particles. And so now we can see that in fact there are three delta functions here and three integrals here. So we perform the integrals and they can be identified. Yes. Oh, is there a question? Okay.
I do have a question. Sorry, can I ask a quick question? Is this delta function of z minus z bar a particularity of 2-2-2? How would it be 2-3 and 2-4 amplitudes? Could you say a little bit about the general 2-2n particles?
For generic higher point amplitudes, there isn't this constraint. There's no constraint on the angles.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you could get perhaps some? So would you say that this is a degenerate case? And therefore, should one look at the general case first and then study this particular case? Or do you think even though it looks a bit singular, this 2-2-2 is still the place to start?
Okay, so I think, you know, for physical reasons, we definitely want to understand a 2-2-2 scattering amplitude. Like that's sort of the most interesting and basic question. Yeah, I think it depends on the type of question you want to ask is the truth. Yes, if you're worried about this singularity, then maybe you want to study higher point functions and all you need to do is look at a 5-point function and it's not there anymore. So, yeah.
Okay, we can discuss more later. Thanks.
So let's perform this integral and rearrange. And what we find is this following decomposition. And so basically there are sort of two factors that are to understand. So we have this first factor here, which is basically just fixed by kinematics. It's taking care of the kinematics. And the second factor, okay, sorry. The second factor is capturing the dynamics. And what we found is that actually it's simply related to the dynamical content of the momentum space amplitude by a single Mellin transform, and in particular with respect to this energy. And so thus we see that this center mass energy is really traded for the sum of the conformal dimensions, which I'm representing by this parameter beta, modulo an offset. Okay, so now we have this simple formula for transforming 2-to-2 momentum space amplitudes into special amplitudes. Let's start to investigate their properties. And the first thing I want to draw your attention to is that there's something manifestly anti-Wilsonian about them. So what I mean by that is, recall in the standard Wilsonian framework, low energy physics is insensitive to the details of the UV. And this decoupling is, of course, explicitly obvious when one truncates the effect of field theory expansion at low energies. Now, in contrast, celestial amplitudes are sensitive to UV physics. And so in particular, as I'll show, there's a drastic difference if one truncates the effective field theory expansion. And in this sense, celestial amplitudes don't really exist only exist for consistent UV complete theories. And the physical reason that underlies this UV sensitivity is simply that boost eigenstates inherently contain contributions of arbitrarily high energy. Okay, so it's instructive to see how this plays out in a specific example. So let's consider the scattering of massless scalars that's mediated by a massive exchange in the S channel. So in momentum space, this admits an effective field theory expansion at low energies, where here, as before, I've written the Mandelstam invariant S in terms of this energy omega. So now let's consider the celestial amplitude for just the leading term, which we obtain by this Mellin transform. So this integral is marginally convergent, and we can interpret it as a delta function. However, if we want to as soon as we start trying to include any of the subleading terms, well, they immediately ruin this marginal convergence and cause the, you know, in particular, cause this integral to diverge in the upper limit. And so this simple example demonstrates the statement that celestial amplitudes don't really exist for truncated effective field theories. However, if we transform the full, not truncated amplitude, then we obtain just a simple and well-defined result. But, you know, this sort of begs the question whether we expect celestial amplitudes to exist in a theory of quantum gravity. And in fact, we do, and that's thanks to the universal soft behavior at high energy. So the fact that scattering amplitudes in theories of quantum gravity admit universally soft behavior at high energies is a reflection of the physics of black hole production. Energies much greater than the Planck scale should produce black holes with order one probability. Now the total probability is given by a sum over the probability for producing each black hole microstate, of which there are exponentially many, where the exponent is given by the Bekenstein-Hawking area entropy law. And so this implies that the amplitude for producing any given microstate is exponentially small in the center of mass energy. And likewise, the exclusive 2-to-2 scattering amplitude, which is approximated at high energy by a sum over intermediate black hole microstates, is also exponentially small in the center of mass energy. So what we learned from the last slide is that we expect momentum space scattering amplitudes in a theory of quantum gravity to emit exponentially damped behavior at high energy. And this exponentially soft behavior ensures that the upper limit of integration will always converge, and therefore we expect these amplitudes to be analytic in beta along the positive real axis. Now, on the other hand, we expect different analytic behavior from an ordinary quantum field theory in which in momentum space instead emits a power law falloff at high energy. So to determine the resulting behavior of a celestial amplitude, we need only consider the contribution that arises from this upper limit of integration. So specifically, if we have an amplitude that's falling off with a power 2m, then the integral converges provided beta is less than 2m, and there is a simple pole at beta equals 2m. So thus, field theory amplitudes will emit simple poles along the positive real axis, positive real beta axis. And indeed, we can see these poles explicitly in this toy example that I presented earlier.
Can I ask you about the question? I mean, maybe it's a technical thing, but so you are taking the integral at fixed z, so at fixed ratio t over s, right?
That's correct.
So that sounds like fixed scattering angle.
That's correct.
Whether this black hole argument seems to work for fixed t and increasing s, or at least that's the usual way it's presented.
No, this statement is supposed to be a fixed angle statement.
Okay, so fixed angle will be dominated by black hole production. Okay.
Yeah, that's the standard statement, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm almost done. And right. Okay, so now that we've established that celestial amplitudes exist in theories of quantum gravity, the last thing to do is to return to the infinite dimensional symmetries from the first part of the talk. And so in momentum space, we saw that the associated constraints were the soft theorems, and these involved a low energy limit of an external graviton. But based on the fact that boost eigenstates involve contributions from all energies, it's not obvious why soft theorems should play any role in celestial amplitudes. Nevertheless, the fact that they could be interpreted as arising from a symmetry supports sort of the opposite conclusion that there should be a celestial avatar of soft theorems. And in fact, this turns out to be the correct conclusion. So to see this, all we need to do is apply similar logic as we use to deduce the behavior of celestial amplitudes due to the power law falloff of field theory amplitudes in the UV. And so in this case, we can determine the resulting behavior of celestial amplitudes due to soft theorems by studying the contribution that arises instead from the lower range of the integration. So the basic logic can be understood by simply studying the Mellin transform of a function that emits a Laurent expansion around omega equals zero. So we can use this Laurent expansion to approximate the contribution from the integral around omega equals zero. And what we find is that the transform has simple poles at delta, at integer delta that is less than or equal to one. And the residues of those poles are precisely the Laurent, the coefficients in the Laurent expansion. So if we directly import this logic to the soft theorems, then we conclude that celestial amplitudes emit simple poles in the conformal dimension of an external graviton with universal residues. And so in gravity, the first three terms in the Laurent expansion are known to be universal. And this implies that there should be poles at 1, 0, and minus 1 in celestial amplitudes with universal residues. And this property has been checked explicitly in a number of examples. And sort of the benefit, it turns out, of studying celestial amplitudes is that actually in this language, it turns out to be more convenient for studying properties of soft theorems. So and in particular, the subleading ones. And this is essentially because it repackages them in terms of simple analyticity conditions that are manifesting Lorentz invariant. And what I mean by that is that if you contrast what's happening in momentum space, then the universal content, namely these factors here, always appears as the coefficient of a power of energy, which is just not a Lorentz invariant quantity. And so as a result, many of the analyses that involve the subleading soft theorems require a careful understanding. The analyses in momentum space require a careful understanding of how to take an appropriate order of limits. Okay, so let me wrap up. So I began by introducing the scattering problem as both a central element to our understanding of quantum gravity and a problem that seemed ripe for investigation since it appeared to be highly constrained. And the next part of the talk focused on the constraints on low energy behavior that are known as soft theorems. And so in particular, I explained that these could be identified as constraints due to infinite dimensional symmetries of the scattering problem. Then the observation that scattering in 4D emits a Bureau-Soros symmetry of 2D conformal field theories led us to study celestial amplitudes which represent the scattering of particles in boost eigenstates. And in so reframing the scattering problem, we discovered that universal constraints on high and low energy behavior in momentum space could be captured by simple analyticity conditions for celestial amplitudes. And so in particular, I presented a number of constraints on the analytic structure in the conformal dimension. And nevertheless, there's also likely a very rich structure in the conformal cross ratio that still has yet to be explored. And in particular, I think that the growing literature on the conformal bootstrap and conformal field theories could prove useful for guiding such an investigation. And finally, I think it would be very interesting to know whether other constraints on scattering amplitude, such as those from causality or unitarity, have simple representations or interesting interpretations in celestial amplitudes. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Monica. So there were a number of questions during the talk. Can I start by asking if there are any student questions? If not, Lee, I see you have a hand.
Yes, there's a way that some of us have been thinking about black hole thermodynamics in which the constraint plays an important role, which says that there's a relationship between the helicity and the boost eigenvalue. And that turns out to be related to imposing the first law of thermodynamics, which turns out to give the typical behavior at a horizon. Is that playing any role? Do you have the dominance at high energy of black hole formation?
Sorry, what was the whole thing you said?
So since you have the dominance by black hole formation, and one way to recognize dominance by black holes is that you have black hole thermodynamics, which for some of us is a relationship between a boost eigenvalue and a spin eigenvalue or helicity eigenvalue.
You're asking me whether, so in this context, there's a priori.
I'm wondering if you have, it's a long shot, but I'm wondering if you have any kind of such relation.
If we have the, sorry, my internet.
If you find that the states naturally organize themselves into a relationship between eigenstate of helicity and eigenstate of boost energy or boost.
So at this point, really, all we understand is we understand essentially how those labels, how to go from sort of momentum space labels into conformal dimension or boost weight and spin labels. But as for what, so your question is asking more like what is the correct, you know, particle content? And we don't know what that is.
It's not so much, well, let's discuss it later.
Or modes, yeah. Which is actually an open question. Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I wanna come back to the question about like physical meaning of the soft charges. So. I'm just trying to understand what they are. So it's not something we can, I mean, it's obviously not something like electric charge, yeah, which we can just go and measure and which is conserved in time. So what is, how should I think about the soft charges, you know, like, they're not conserved, yeah. Apart from this memory interpretation, what else like, we can say about them? What they are good for, okay.
What are they good for? Okay, so maybe to answer your first question of conserved in time, so, the charges that are conserved in time are the ones that have both the hard and the soft contribution. Mm-hmm. So what it's telling you is that I measure, let me write another expression that I, let's see. Okay, so. In gravity, this Q hard is something like some integral of like the stress tensor. And Q soft, you can think of, right, as I said before, like some integral of, let's say, a graviton. Mm-hmm. And so what it's telling you, and the thing that is conserved is Q, which is equal to QH plus QS. And so these charges, the way it works is that, and let me say also, okay, so these depend on, let's say, the direction, some direction on the sphere, everything. And so it's saying that if I have some energy that's coming out at some angle, and I pick it out, and I pick, and I pick it out with this hard charge, then the thing that is conserved in time is the sum of the energy that I register plus this contribution from, well, one way to say it is the zero frequency part of the graviton field. And so it is that sum that is constrained in time. One interpretation of the soft charge is that it's telling you that there is a, that the asymptotic metric is shifting in time. And so like in a scattering process, if basically radiation comes out, then right, distances on the sphere change according to essentially this conservation law. Another maybe a complementary way of thinking about this is you can ask, so we interpreted this hard charge as sort of implementing these transformations on the single particle states. And so maybe we should think a little bit harder and try and think of the soft charge as also sort of, you know, it should be transforming something. So what does it transform? First thing to notice is that, so this thing really, right, was like, well, some zero frequency graviton, so it carries no energy. So what that means is that if you act with QS on some vacuum state, it carries no energy, so whatever you get is also another vacuum. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that, so it turns out that what you can show is that these the soft charges really are actually transforming the vacuum state in the sense that they're adding soft gravitons. And moreover, that if you don't allow for multiple different degenerate vacua, then in a quantum field theory amplitude, this translates into the statement that it won't satisfy the constraints and it will vanish. And this was sort of known in another way in the sense in it, as that quantum field theory amplitudes vanish due to infrared divergences that are sort of, that arise in loops. Mm-hmm. And so you can show that actually if you create or if you construct states that sort of allow, sort of that have these different, that have different vacua and or sort of different contents of soft gravitons that such that they satisfy the constraints, then you've solved this infrared divergence problem and you, and the result is that you get infrared finite S matrix elements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, I think that since there have been a lot of good questions and in view of time, is unless there's maybe one last pressing. Laurent, do you have a question?
Yeah, we have a question about so this this notion of universal softening of quantum gravity amplitudes in the UV. You described it in the 2-2 scattering where there's only like one parameter that controls the softening. Is there a way to understand exactly how you would express that for a general scattering amplitude? Like a 2-2n scattering amplitude?
No, I mean, I think that there's a, I mean, even what I wrote was very heuristic, right? Like it was, you know, one doesn't need, like, how you don't even know, you know, this model sort of naively assumes that all of the energy and actually went into forming the black hole. Like, there could be an order one, you know, number here. This is a very schematic.
Is there a way, if I push you in that direction, is there a way to understand, let's say, what structure would expect in the pole structure of the CFT for theories which are UV complete, a la gravity? You know, is that where you're going somehow? That there's maybe a new way to look at UV completion?
A new way to look at UV completion. I think the general expectation, even for the higher point amplitudes, is that there is going to be this exponentially soft behavior. Essentially because, like, I didn't really need, you know, this sort of argument. Again, like, if you send three particles in and you scatter them at energies much, much higher than the Planck scale, then you would also expect that you should produce a black hole with order one. And so actually, like, this argument really didn't rely on what that these were, like, two particle states. I could have run this argument saying in particle states, and generally then I think you would expect.
Is there a way to be more specific, let's say?
More specific?
Yeah, more specific about what happened. I mean, what does the UV completed theory looks like? There's a softening, but, you know, and the in your basis, it means that you resolve certain poles. I'm just asking whether somehow beyond these very general statements, there's a way or the hope that maybe you could be a bit more. Or are you saying, in fact, you don't get new?
Sorry.
I was okay. It's just that I was thinking that what you were saying is that by looking at it with this in this new way, you could have a more sharp way to talk about these issues. But that's not what you're saying.
So one of the things is that, you know, one thing that people have been looking at in a lot more detail is things like constraints from causality and unitarity. And that program, essentially, they're interested in momentum space in amplitudes at large S and fixed T, or possibly taking t to zero. And there you find many of these positivity constraints, but on the coefficients of low energy effective action, but it's unclear. There's also this general expectation that if you're working in a different limit, and so namely you take s and t to infinity at fixed ratio, so this fixed angle limit, this is the physical picture that people generally expect. And this constraint, or at least as far as I understand from the research that's been done, it's unclear how you implement this particular constraint in that language. So in other words, they're finding all these sort of different conditions that you would find that are implied by causality and unitarity, but you also expect this to be a physically relevant condition, and it's sort of opaque in that language. And so the idea here is that we now have it captured by some simple analyticity condition. Like in momentum space, right, you have to take some limit and say something. And here it's strictly written to the analytic behavior of this amplitude. And that's I think the main point of what we said so far.
And it's okay. So in some sense, it's more precise. I mean, I was getting it's kind of more precise.
It's a statement that seems possibly easier to work with, right? Like, mm-hmm. If you understand things in terms of analyticity statements, then perhaps you understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you understand the full analytic behavior, then you know what it's everywhere, right? So that would be like a.
And is there a simple analytic statements in for IR?
For IR physics.
Higher amplitudes. like 2 to n, not just 2 to 2? Like,
yeah, so actually, you know, indeed, that hasn't been fully worked out. So, you know, my suspicion is that, like, right here, we found that sort of the celestial avatar of the matrix element in momentum space, so the thing that only depends on the center mass energy and the momentum transfer, is this function that depends on the sum of the conformal dimensions and the cross ratio. Now, of course, there are more independent parameters when you go to higher points, and so it's not known, as far as I know, what they do depend on. So it could be,
okay, I mean,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go further.
Okay, thank you.
Is Lee asking?
Yes, I'm going to risk my appearing dumb again for a second time. What you mean when you say that the cross section is dominated by black holes, is it that you're at an energy E and the cross section is the area of a black hole, that mass, so that all the amplitude goes into the production of black holes?
Yes, I mean, but I never said that.
I know you never said that.
And I think that the state of the art right now is that there are many squiggles. Like, we don't really, you know, there have been, as I understand, you know, there's been even some, what they're interesting, like, sort of more GR calculations about this. But yeah, I don't think this has been.
But you insist on unitarity as well. So you're not telling a story where you make little black holes and they lose their phases and you lose unitarity.
Yeah, I guess my perspective is that unitarity is a reasonable thing to assume, but
good.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. My suggestion is at that point we cut it off and thank Monica one more time for a very pedagogical and exciting talk.